The following chapter is in the book, Lectures to My Students, Charles Spurgeon, Keeping the Attention of the Congregation or Hearers. Our subject today is one which is scarcely noticed in any books upon the art of preaching. A very curious fact, for it is a most important matter and worthy of more than one chapter. I suppose the homiletical scholars consider that their entire volumes are seasoned with this subject, and that they need not give it to us in lumps, because like sugar and tea, it flavors a whole. That overlooked topic is how to obtain and retain the attention of our hearers. Their attention must be gained, or nothing can be done with them. And it must be retained, or we may go on spinning words with no good will to come of it. Over the head of military announcements, our English officers always place a word, attention, in large capital letters. We need some such word over all our sermons. We need the earnest, candid, wakeful, continued attention of all those who are in the congregation. If men's minds are wandering far away, they cannot receive the truth, and it is much the same way as if they are inactive. Sin cannot be taken out of men while they are fast asleep, as Eve was taken out of the sight of Adam. They must be awake and understanding what we are saying, feeling its force, or else we may as well go to sleep as well. There are preachers who care very little whether they are listened to or not, so long as they can hold on through the allotted time. It is of very small importance to them whether their people hear for eternity or hear in vain. The sooner such ministers sleep in the churchyard and preach by the verse on their gravestones, the better. Some brethren speak up toward the ventilators as if they sought the attention of the angels. Others look down upon their book as if they were absorbed in thought or had themselves for an audience and felt much honored by it. Why do not such brethren preach on the prairie and edify the stars? If their preaching has no reference to their hearers, they might do so with evident propriety. If a sermon be a soliloquy, the more lonely the performer, the better. To our rational preacher, and all are not rational, it must seem essential to interest all his audience from the oldest to the youngest. We ought not to make even children inattentive. Make them inattentive, say you? Who does that? I say that most preachers do. When children are not quiet in a meeting, it is often as much our fault as theirs. Can you not put in a little story or parable on purpose for the little ones? Can you not catch the eye of the boy in the gallery and the little girl downstairs who have begun to fidget and smile them into order? I often talk with my eyes to the orphan boys at the foot of my pulpit. We want all eyes fixed upon us and all ears open to us. To me it is an annoyance if even a blind man does not look at me with his face. If I see anybody turning around, whispering, nodding, or looking at his watch, I judge that I am not up to the mark and must by some means win these minds. Very seldom have I to complain, and when I do, my general plan is to complain of myself, and own that I have no right to attention unless I know how to command it. Now there are some congregations whose attention you do not readily gain. They do not care to be interested. It is useless to scold them. That would be like throwing a bush at a bird to catch it. Fact is, in most cases, there is another person whom you should scold, and that is yourself. It may be their duty to be attentive, but it is far more your duty to make them do so. You must attract the fish to your hook, and if they do not come, you should blame the fishermen and not the fish. Compel them to stand still a while and hear what God the Lord would speak to their souls. The minister who recommended the old lady to take snuff in order to keep from dozing was very properly rebuked by her reply that if he would put more snuff into the sermon, she would stay awake. We must plentifully cast snuff into the sermon or something yet more awakening. Recollect that to some of our people it is not so easy to be attentive. Many of them are not interested in the matter and have not felt enough of any gracious operation on their hearts to make them confess that the gospel is of any special value to them. Concerning the Savior whom you preach, you may say to them, Is it nothing to you, all ye that pass by? Is it nothing to you that Jesus should die? Many of them have, through the week, been borne down by the press of business cares. They ought to roll their burden on the Lord, but do you always do so? Do you always find it easy to escape from anxieties? Are you able to forget the sick wife and the ailing children at home? There is no doubt whatsoever that many come into the house of God loaded heavily with the thoughts of their daily occupations. The farmer recollects the fields that are to be plowed or to be sown. It is a wet Sunday, and he is reflecting upon the yellow look of the young wheats. The merchant sees that dishonored bill fluttering before his eyes, and the tradesman counts over his bad debts. I should not wonder if the colors of the lady's ribbons and the creak of the gentleman's boots disturb many. There are troublesome flies about. You know, Beelzebub, the god of flies, takes care that wherever there is a gospel feast, the guest should be worried with petty annoyances. Often mental mosquitoes sting the man while you are preaching to him, and he is thinking more of trifling distractions than of your discourse. Is it so very wonderful that he does? You must drive the mosquitoes away and secure your people's undistracted thoughts, turning them out of the channel in which they have been running for 6 days into one suitable for the Sabbath. You must have sufficient leverage in your discourse, and it's subject to lift them right up from the earth to which they cleave and to elevate them a little nearer to the heaven. Frequently, it is very difficult for congregations to be attentive because of the place and the atmosphere. For instance, if the place is like this room at present, sealed against the pure air with every window closed, they have enough to do to breathe and cannot think of anything else. When people have inhaled over and over again the air which has been in other people's lungs, the whole machinery of life gets out of gear, and they are more likely to feel an aching head than a broken heart. The next best thing to the grace of God for a preacher is oxygen. Pray that the windows of heaven may be opened, but begin by opening the windows of your meeting house. Look at many of our country places, and I'm afraid our city chapels too, and you will find that the windows are not made to be opened. The modern barbaric style of building gives us no more ceiling than a barn, and no more openings for ventilation than would be found in an oriental dungeon where the tyrant expected his prisoner to die by inches. What would we think of a house where the windows could not be open? Would any of you rent such a dwelling? Yet Gothic architecture and silly pride make many persons renounce the wholesome sash window for little holes in the ceiling or bird traps in the windows. And so places are made far less comfortable than Nebuchadnezzar's furnace was to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Provided all such chapels were properly insured, I cannot pray for their preservation from fire. Even where the windows will open, they are often kept closed by the month, and from Sunday to Sunday, the impure atmosphere is unchanged. This ought not to be endured. I know some people do not notice such things, and I have heard it remarked that foxes are not killed by the stench of their own holes. But I am not a fox. Bad air makes me and my hearers dull. A gust of fresh air through the building might be to the people the next best thing to the gospel itself. At least it would put them into a fit frame of mind to receive the truth. Make it a point on weekdays to remove the hindrance arising from foul air. In my former chapel on Park Street, I mentioned to my deacon several times my opinion that the upper panes of the iron frame windows had better be taken out, as the windows were not made to open. I mentioned this several times and nothing came of it, but it providentially happened one Monday that somebody removed most of those panes in a masterly manner, almost as well as if they had been taken out by one who sets glass. There was considerable consternation and much conjecture as to who had committed the crime, and I proposed that a reward of £5 should be offered for the discovery of the offender, who when found should receive the amount as a present. The reward was not forthcoming, and therefore I have not felt it to be my duty to inform against that individual. I trust none of you will suspect me, for if you do, I shall have to confess that I have walked with the stick, which let the oxygen into that stifling structure. Sometimes the manners of our people are detrimental to attention. They are not in the habit of listening. They attend the chapel, but do not attend the preacher. They are accustomed to look around at everyone who enters the place, and they come in at all times, sometimes with much stamping, squeaking of boots, and banging of doors. I was preaching once to a people who continually looked around, and I adopted the expediency of saying, "Now, friends, as it is so very interesting to you to know who comes in, and it disturbs me so very much for you to look around, I will, if you like, describe each one as he comes in, so that you may sit and look at me and keep up at least a show of decency." I described a gentleman who entered in at that moment, who happened to be a friend whom I could depict without offense, as a very respectable gentleman who had just taken his hat off, and so on. After that one attempt, I found it was not necessary to describe any more, because they felt shocked at what I was doing, and I assured them that I was much more shocked that they should render it necessary for me to reduce our conduct to such an absurdity. It cured them for the time being, and I hope forever, much to their pastor's joy. We will now suppose that this is set right. You have let the foul air out of the place and reformed the manners of the people. What next? In order to get attention, the first golden rule is always say something worth hearing. Most persons possess an instinct which leads them to desire to hear a good thing. They have a similar instinct also, which you had better take note of, namely, that which prevents their seeing the good of attentively listening to mere words. It is not a severe criticism to say that there are ministers whose words stand in a very large proportion to their thoughts. In fact, their words hide their thoughts, if they have any. They pour out heaps of chaff, and perhaps there may be somewhere or other an ode or two, but it would be hard to say where. Congregations will not long attend to words, 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 and nothing else. Amongst the commandments, I am not aware of one which runs thus, "Thou shalt not be verbose." But it may be comprehended under the command, "Thou shalt not steal." For it is a fraud upon your hearers to give them words instead of spiritual food. In a multitude of words there wanteth not sin, even in the best preacher. Give your hearers something which they can treasure up and remember, something likely to be useful to them, the best manner from the best of places, solid doctrine from the divine word. Give them manna fresh from the skies and not the same thing over and over again in the same form ad nauseam. Like workhouse bread cut into the same shape all the year round. Give them something striking, something that a man might get up in the middle of the night to hear, and worth his walking 50 miles to listen to. You're quite capable of doing that. Do it, brethren. Do it continually, and you will have all the attention you desire. Let the good material which you give them be very clearly arranged. There is a great deal in that. It is possible to heap up a vast mass of good things all in a muddle. Ever since the day I was sent to shop with a basket to purchase a pound of tea, a quarter pound of mustard, and 3 pounds of rice, and on my way home saw a pack of hounds and felt it necessary to follow them over hedge and ditch, as I always did when I was a boy, and found when I reached home that all the goods were amalgamated, tea, mustard, and rice, all into one awful mess. I then understood the necessity of packing up my subjects in good stout parcels, bound around with the thread of my discourse. This makes me keep to firstly, secondly, and thirdly, however unfashionable that method may now be. People will not drink your mustardy tea, nor will they enjoy muddled-up sermons in which you cannot tell the head from the tail, because they have neither, and are like Mr. Bright's Skye Terrier, whose head and tail were both alike. Put the truth before men in a logical, orderly manner, so that they can easily remember it, and will the more readily receive it. Be sure, moreover, to speak plainly. However excellent your matter, if a man does not comprehend it, it can be of no use to him. You might as well have spoken to him in the language of Russia's Kamchatka as in your own tongue. If you use phrases that are quite out of his line and modes of expression which are not suitable to his mind, go up to his level. If he is a poor man, go down to his understanding. If he is an educated person. You smile at my contorting the terms in that manner, but I think there is more going up and being plain to the illiterate than there is in being refined for the polite. At any rate, it is the more difficult of the two and most like the Savior's mode of speech. It is wise to walk in a path where your auditors can accompany you and not to mount a high horse and ride over their heads. Our Lord and Master was a king of preachers, and yet he never was above anybody's comprehension except so far as the grandeur and glory of his manner were concerned. His words and utterances were such that he spoke like the Holy Child Jesus. Let your hearts incite a good matcher, clearly arranged and plainly put, and you are pretty sure to gain the ear, and so the heart. Attend also to your manner of address. Aim at the improvement of your listener's attention. As a rule, do not read your sermons. There have been a few readers who have exercised great power in gaining attention, as for example, Thomas Chalmers, who could not have had a more attentive audience had he been extemporizing. But then I do not suppose that we are equal to Thomas Chalmers. Men of such eminence may read if they prefer it, but for us, there is a more excellent way. The best reading I have ever heard has tasted of paper and is stuck in my throat. I have not relished it, for my digestion is not good enough to dissolve a piece of writing paper. It is better to do without the manuscript, even if you are driven to recite. It is best of all if you need neither to recite nor to read. If you must read, mind that you do it to perfection. Be the very best of readers, and you need to be if you want to secure their attention. Let me say that if you would be listened to, do not extemporize in the emphatic sense, for that is as bad as reading. Or perhaps worse, unless a manuscript was written extemporaneously, I mean without previous study. Do not go into the pulpit and say the first thing that comes to your head, for the uppermost thing with most men is mere froth. Your people need discourses which have been prayed over and laboriously prepared. People do not want raw food. It must be cooked and made ready for them. We must give out of our very souls the words which naturally suggest themselves. The matter which has been as thoroughly prepared by us as possible for a sermon writer. Indeed, it should be even better prepared if we would speak well. In my opinion, the best method is not to extemporize the matter, but extemporize the words. The language comes to him at the moment, but the theme has been well thought out. And like the master in Israel, he speaks of that which he knows and testifies of what he has seen. In order to get attention, make your manner as pleasing as possible. Do not, for instance, indulge in monotones. Vary your voice continually. Vary your speed as well, by racing as rapidly as a lightning flash and then travel forward in quiet majesty. Shift your accent. Move your emphasis, but avoid sing-song. Vary the tone. Use the bass sometimes and let the thunders roll within. At other times, speak as you generally do from the lips and let your speech be conversational. Anything for a change. Human nature craves variety, and God grants it in nature, providence, and grace. Let us have it in sermons also. I shall not, however, dwell much upon this, because preachers have been known to arouse and sustain attention with their subject matter alone, even when their mode of speech has been very imperfect. If Richard Sibbs, the Puritan, were here this afternoon, I would guarantee him fixed attention to anything that he had to say. And yet he stammered, lisped, and hissed dreadfully. We need not look for instances of this in modern pulpits, for there are far too many. But we may remember that Moses was slow of speech, and yet every ear was attentive to his words. Probably Paul also labored under a similar infirmity, for his speech was said to be contemptible. Of this, however, we are not sure, for it was only the criticism of enemies. Paul's power in the churches was very great, and yet he was not always able to maintain attention when his sermon was long, for at least one hearer went to sleep under him with serious results. Manner is not everything. Still, if you have gathered good subject matter, it is a pity to convey it callously. A king should not ride in a dust cart, nor should the glorious doctrines of grace be slovenly delivered. Right royal truth should ride in a chariot of gold. Bring forth the noblest of your milk-white steeds, and let the music sound forth melodiously. From the silver trumpets as truth rides through the streets. People do not attend, do not let it be the fault of our flawed utterance. If, however, we cannot mend in this respect, let us be the more diligent to make up for it by the richness of our matter. And on all occasions, let us do our very best. As a rule, do not make the introduction too long. It is always a pity to build a great porch to a little house. An excellent Christian woman once heard John Howe preach. He usually took up to an hour in his preface, and she observed that the dear good man was so long a time in laying the cloth that she lost her appetite. She did not think there would be any dinner after all. Spread your table quickly and have done with the clatter of the knives and the plates. You may have seen a certain edition of Philip Doddridge's The Rise and Progress of Religion in the Soul, with an introductory essay by John Foster. The essay is both bigger and better than the book and deprives Doddridge of the chance of being read. Is this not preposterous? Avoid this error in your own assemblies. I prefer to make the introduction of a sermon very like that of the town crier who rings his bell and cries, "Oh yes, oh yes." This is to give notice, merely to let people know that he has news for them and wants them to listen. To do that, the introduction should have something striking in it. It is well to fire a startling shot as a signal gun to clear the decks for action. Do not start at the full pitch and tension of your mind, but start in such a way that all will be led to expect a good time. Do not make your introduction a pompous one that leads into nothing, but rather as a step that advances to something better still. Be alive at the very onset. In preaching, do not repeat yourselves. I used to listen to a preacher who, after he had uttered about a dozen sentences, would say, "As I have already observed," or, "I repeat what I before remarked." Well, good soul, as there was nothing particular in what he had said, the repetition only revealed the more clearly the nakedness of the land. If it was very good and you said it forcibly, why go over it again? And if it was a feeble affair, why exhibit it a second time? Occasionally, of course, a repetition of a few sentences may be very telling. Anything may be good occasionally and yet be a very vicious habit. Who wonders that people do not listen the first time when they know it is all to come over again? Furthermore, do not restate the same idea again and again in different words. Let there be something fresh in each sentence. Be not forever hammering away at the same nail. Yours is a large Bible, so permit the people to enjoy its length and breadth. And brethren, do not think it necessary or important every time you preach to give a complete summary of theology or a formal digest of doctrines after the manner of John Gill. Not that I would discredit or speak a word against Gill. His method is admirable for a body of divinity or for a commentary, but not suitable for preaching. I know a preacher whose sermons, whenever they are printed, read like theological summaries, more fitted for a classroom than for a pulpit. They fall flat on the public ear. Our hearers do not want the bare bones of technical definition. They want meat and flavor. Definitions and differences are all very well, but when they are the staple of a sermon, they remind us of the young man whose discourse was made up of various important distinctions. Upon this performance, an old deacon observed that there was one distinction which he had omitted, namely the distinction between meat and bones. If preachers do not make that distinction, all their other distinctions will not bring them much distinction. In order to maintain attention, avoid being too long. An old preacher used to say to a young man who preached for an hour, "My dear friend, I do not care what else you preach about, but I wish you would always preach about 40 minutes. We should seldom go much beyond that. 40 minutes or say 3/4 of an hour. If a fellow cannot say all he has to say in that time, when will he say it?" But somebody said he liked to do justice to his subject. Well, but ought he not to do justice to his people, or at least have a little mercy upon them and not keep them too long? The subject will not complain of you, but the people will. In some country places, in the afternoon especially, the farmers have to milk their cows, and one farmer bitterly complained to me about a young man, I think from this college, saying, "Sir, he ought to have given over at 4 o'clock, but he kept on till 1/2 past, and there were all my cows waiting to be milked. How would he have liked it if he had been a cow?" There was a great deal of sense in that question. The Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals ought to have prosecuted that young man. How can farmers profit by the sermon when they have cows on the brain? A mother feels morally certain during that extra 10 minutes of your sermon that the baby is crying, or the fire in the stove is out, and she cannot and will not give her heart to your ministrations. You are keeping her 10 minutes longer than she bargained for, and she looks upon it as a piece of injustice on your part. There is a kind of moral compact between you and your congregation that you will not weary them more than 1.5 hours. And if you keep them longer, it amounts to an infraction of a treaty and a piece of practical dishonesty of which you ought not to be guilty. Brevity is a virtue within the reach of all of us. Do not let us lose the opportunity of gaining the credit which it brings. If you ask me how you may shorten your sermons, I should say study them better. Spend more time in the study so that you may need less time in the pulpit. We are generally longest when we have least to say. A man with a great deal of well-prepared manner will probably not exceed 40 minutes. When he has less to say, he will go on for 50 minutes. And when he has absolutely nothing to say, he will need 1 hour to say it. Attend to these minor things, and they will help to retain attention. If you want to have the attention of your people, to have it thoroughly and always, it can only be accomplished by their being led by the Spirit of God into an elevated and devout state of mind. If your people are teachable, prayerful, active, earnest, and devout, they will come to the house of God on purpose to get a blessing. They will take their seats prayerfully, asking God to speak to them through you. They will remain on the watch for every word and will not weary. They will have an appetite for the gospel, for they know the sweetness of the heavenly manna, and they will be eager to gather their appointed portions. No man will ever have a congregation to preach to which surpasses my own in this respect. Indeed, those with whom the preacher is most at home are usually the best hearers of him. It is comparatively easy for me to preach at the tabernacle. My people come on purpose to hear something, and their expectation helps to fulfill itself. If they would hear another preacher with the same expectancy, I believe they would generally be satisfied, though there are exceptions. When the preacher first settles into his pastorate, he cannot expect that his congregation will give him that solemn, earnest attention which those obtain who stand up like fathers among their own children, and dear to their people by 1,000 memories and esteem for age and experience. Our whole life must be such as to add weight to our words so that in after years we shall be able to wield the invincible eloquence of a long-sustained character and obtain not merely the attention but also the affectionate respect of our flock. If by our prayers, tears, and labors our people become spiritually healthy, we need not fear that we shall lose their attention. A people hungering after righteousness and a minister anxious to feed their souls will act in sweetest harmony with each other when their common theme is the word of the Lord. If you need another direction for winning attention, I should say be interesting yourself and you will interest others. There is more in those words than there seems to be. I will not follow a custom which I just condemned and repeat the sentence, "Be interested in yourself, and you will interest other people." Your subject must weigh so much upon your own mind that you dedicate all your faculties at their best to the deliverance of your soul concerning it. And then when your hearers see that the topic has engrossed you, it will by degrees engross them. Do you wonder that people do not attend to a man who does not feel that he has anything important to say? Do you wonder that they do not listen with all their ears when a man does not speak with all his heart? Do you marvel that their thoughts ramble to their own concerns when they find that the preacher is wasting time over manners which he treats as if they were fictions? William Romaine used to say, "It was well to understand the art of preaching, but infinitely better to know the heart of preaching." In that saying, there is no little weight. The heart of preaching, the throwing of the soul into it, the earnestness which pleases for life itself, is half the battle as to gaining attention. At the same time, you cannot hold men's minds in rapt attention by mere earnestness if you have nothing to say. People will not stand at their doors forever to hear a fellow beat a drum. They will come out to see what he is up to, but when they find that it is much ado about nothing, they will slam the door and go in again, as much as to say, "You have taken us in, and we do not like it." Therefore, have something to say, and say it earnestly, and the congregation will be at your feet. It may be a superfluous to remark that for the mass of our people, it is well that there should be a goodly number of illustrations in our discourses. We have the example of our Lord for that, and most of the greatest preachers have abounded in similes, metaphors, allegories, and anecdotes. But beware of overdoing this business. I read the other day the diary of a German lady who has been converted from Lutheranism to our faith, and she speaks of a certain village where she lives. "There is a mission station here, and young men come down to preach to us. I do not wish to find fault with these young gentlemen, but they tell us a great many very pretty little stories, and I do not think there is much else in what they say. Also, I have heard some of their little stories before, therefore they do not interest me as they would do if they would tell us some good doctrine out of the Scriptures." The same thing has no doubt crossed many other minds. Pretty stories are all very well, but it will never do to rely upon them as the great attraction of a sermon. Moreover, take warning concerning certain of these pretty little stories, for their day is over and gone. The poor things are worn threadbare and ought to go into the rag bag. I have heard some of them so many times that I could tell them myself, but there is no need. From stock anecdotes may both we and our hearers be mercifully delivered. Ancient jests sicken us when dimwits retell them as their own ideas, and anecdotes to which our grandfathers listened have much the same effect upon our minds. Beware those extremely popular compilations of illustrations which are in every Sunday school teacher's hand, for nobody will thank you for repeating what everybody already knows by heart. If you tell anecdotes, let them have some degree of freshness and originality. Keep your eyes open and gather flowers from the garden with your own hands. They will be far more acceptable than withered specimens borrowed from other men's bouquets, however beautiful they may have once been. Illustrate richly and aptly, but not so much with parables imported from foreign sources as with apt similes growing out of the subject itself. Do not, however, think the illustration to be everything. It is a window, but of what use is the light which it admits if you have nothing for the light to reveal? Garnish your dishes, but remember that the meat is the main point to consider, not the garnishing. Real instruction must be given and solid doctrine taught, or you will find your imagery diminish upon your hearers, and they will pine for spiritual meat. And your sermons cultivate what Mr. Taylor calls the surprise power. There is a great deal of force in that for winning attention. Do not say what everyone expects you to say. Keep your sentences out of the ruts. If you have already said salvation is all of grace, do not add, "and not by human merit," but vary it and say, "Salvation is all of grace. Self-righteousness is not a corner to hide its head in." I fear I cannot recall one of Mr. Taylor's sentences so as to do it justice, but it was something like this: "Some of you make no advance in the divine life because you go forward a little way, and then you float back again. just like a vessel on a tidal river, which goes down with the stream just far enough to be carried back again on the return tide. So you make good progress for a while, and then all of a sudden, what did he say? You hitch up in some muddy creek. Did he not also repeat to us a speech to this effect? He felt sure that if they were converted, they would walk uprightly and keep their bullocks out of their neighbor's corn. Occasional resorts to this system of surprise will keep an audience in a state of proper expectancy. I sat last year about this time on the beach at Mentone by the Mediterranean Sea. The waves were very gently rising and falling, for there is little or no tide and the wind was still. The waves crept up languidly one after another, and I took a little heed of them, though they were just at my feet. Suddenly, as if seized with a new passion, the sea sent up one far-reaching billow which drenched me thoroughly. Quite as I had been before, you can readily conceive how quickly I was on my feet, and how speedily my daydreaming ended. I observed to a ministering brother at my side, "This shows us how to preach. To wake people up, we must astonish them with something they were not looking for. Brethren, take them unawares. Let your thunderbolt drop out of a clear sky. When all is calm and bright, let the tempest rush up, and by contrast make its tears all the greater. Remember, however, that nothing will avail if you go to sleep yourself while you are preaching." Is that possible? Oh, possible. It is done every Sunday. Many ministers are more than half asleep all through their sermons. Indeed, they never were awake at any time and probably never will be unless a cannon should be fired off near their ear. Tame phrases, hackneyed expressions, and dreary monotones make the staple of their discourses, and they wonder that the people are so drowsy. I confess, I do not. A very useful help in securing attention is a pause. Pull up short every now and then, and the passengers on your coach will wake up. The miller goes to sleep while the mill wheels revolve. But if by some means or other the grinding ceases, the good man starts and cries, "What now?" On a sultry summer day, if nothing will keep off the drowsy feeling, be very short. Sing more than usual or call on a brother or two to pray. A minister who saw that the people would sleep sat down and observed, "I saw you were all resting, and I thought I would rest too." Andrew Fuller had barely commenced a sermon when he saw the people going to sleep. He said, "Friends, friends, friends, this won't do. I had thought sometimes when you were asleep that it was my fault, but now you are asleep before I begin, and it must then be your fault. Pray, wake up, and give me an opportunity of doing you some good." Just so. Know how to pause. Make a point of interjecting a rousing parenthesis of quietude. Speech is silver, but silence is golden when hearers are inattentive. Keep on, 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 with commonplace manner and monotonous tone, and you will be rocking the cradle and deeper slumbers will result. Give the cradle a jerk, and sleep will flee.